Group meeting, Friday, 11th September, 1981. Now, this weekend, I thought we might consider the subject of meditation. There's so much talk about meditation nowadays in the Western part of the world. And there is so much that passes off as meditation, which really has nothing to do with meditation. And this applies also to the East, right enough. Because people don't understand what precisely meditation means. If not very precisely, at least have a general conception of it. Something of a vision of what it really is. Now, the dictionary meaning of meditation is musing. Talking silently in your mind over some chosen subject. And in the religious context, referring to some serious subject. But that dictionary meaning is utterly useless as far as meditation in the deep sense is concerned. Now, when we use the word samadhi, the Indian word samadhi, it means something utterly different from the common definitions of meditation in European languages. Meditation in European terms really does mean just musing. There's no doubt about that, you see, or thinking seriously about something or other. But the word samadhi means something entirely different. So I'm going to start off today by asking everyone to bear in mind that the words mind and consciousness stand for universals. They are universal energies, universal realities. You have often heard me say that we cannot talk of my mind, nor can we talk of my consciousness. Because pure consciousness, absolute consciousness, is the very nature of reality at its starting point, so to say. Just as the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy is the starting point. And it must be borne in mind that this primordial creative energy and absolute consciousness are an identity. It is necessary for us to talk as if they were different things. This is energy, that is consciousness. That is not the case. Those two words represent the one identical reality, you see. Consciousness is energy. Energy is consciousness in the pure and absolute sense. Now, this is something which, of course, the world as a whole just doesn't know or doesn't acknowledge. You'll find this, however, stated way back in the Yoga Upanishads of India, particularly in the Varaha Upanishad, that the ultimate reality and the ultimate reality as realized in the supreme meditative state, in the perfect samadhi, is pure absolute consciousness itself. Now, this is perhaps new to you, to talk about the identity of the creative energy and consciousness. They are an identity. Don't think of them as two different things. when the creative energy begins to differentiate, consciousness, the pure absolute consciousness, begins to proliferate, and grades of being come into existence, each characterized by creative energy as well as by pure consciousness. You see, in consciousness too, differentiation takes place, and there is a movement towards concreteness from absolute, from the state of absolute spirituality, of perfect subtlety. You see, there is increasing concreteness. Now, these grades of being which come into existence are in the first stages, in the early stages I should say, they are universals, they are not particulars. There comes the point when particularity at last emerges. One can put it this way also. You remember how often we have talked of mind as that archetypal form of creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. That is mind, pure mind. And as such, it is a universal. It has no characteristics. It has this power, that's all. It has no characteristics. You can't call it good, bad, indifferent. You can't apply any adjectives to mind, as you can to your own psyche. But I've talked about that enough on previous occasions, so we won't spend more time on that, you see. All right. This, just as mind is an archetypal form of the creative energy, and also therefore of consciousness, similarly, there is, if you like to so regard it, archetypal matter, the primordial matter, which is not concrete yet. That is to say, we know matter only as solid, liquid, gaseous, don't we? Other than the solid state, the liquid state, the gaseous state, there is energy, various forms of energy. And we must note very carefully that all these forms of energy need an appropriate physical apparatus through which to manifest. If the apparatus isn't there, that energy cannot manifest. Isn't that so? If you didn't have dynamo and all the rest of it, and an electric bulb, you wouldn't get the effect of the electric energy, as we call it. Now, similarly, therefore, there is this primordial archetypal matter as such, which is not concrete. When that also undergoes the stages of differentiation, we get the world as we experience it and of which we are aware through our senses. You see? Now, mind and consciousness are universals, as I said. They function through the purified psyche only. That is to say, the pure consciousness functions through the purified psyche. And remember this peculiar thing about consciousness. That which you are truly conscious of is not known to you through your brain. You see, how are we ordinarily conscious? We have our five physical senses, and we have the power of thinking, as we commonly call it, of imagining and so forth, you see, which in India was always called material, and they regarded it as a sixth sense, you see, as a sixth sense. Now, when these impressions from the world come to us through our senses, they make an impression upon the brain. The stimuli reach us through our senses of sight, hearing, taste, touch, and so on, and make an impression on the brain. And the brain, having learned language from those around us, symbolical sounds, language is a system of symbolical sounds, the brain synthesizes these impressions and makes a meaningful pattern for our ordinary practical purposes of living. You see, all right, that is the way in which we are conscious. But now, meditation, samadhi, the real samadhi, the real meditation, the pure meditative state, is the activity, or if you like to say, the movement, because what is active is associated with the idea of movement. But this is not a movement in time and space, like a physical object moves through time and space. But you have to, there are no words apart from these physical words to express it. It is a movement or an activity of consciousness on its own, in its own transcendent sphere. It's important to realize that. Which implies, if we know that this is the case, you see, how do we come to know it? Apart from the fact that there are those who have realized it. They have experienced it, you see, and the tradition has come down that way. Now, this is true meditation. Consciousness functioning at its own universal level in the non-universal particular human being. You and I are not universal beings, otherwise we'd fill the entire universe, wouldn't we? But we are not. That is the extraordinary thing. Now, there is a connection, obviously, between our state as it is and that state which can come into being to us. If that state had not come into being through human beings, in the past, and there are those today who can realize it, and there will always be those in the future who will realize that. If there were not such human beings, we would have no understanding of the ultimate goal, the supreme purpose of our existence, and so forth. So, the great religious teachings thereby come into being, the affirmations of transcendence. All the great spiritual teachers affirmed transcendence without exception. They affirmed it in different ways. There were those who affirmed it in theistic terms, primarily because they were of a devotional type. They sensed, they realized something immensely greater than them, entirely universal, which contained oneself, you see, altogether. And for this, they had a feeling of awe and reverence and so forth. And human beings have this peculiar, we as we are, have this peculiar tendency of representing such things which are beyond us in our terms. So God became a father figure, a superhuman being, but human. Notice all the qualities we ascribe to God, the qualities which we ourselves have, but in apotheosis. You see, if we have the quality of love in 10 units, God had the quality of love in 10 to the power 1 million units. It was that sort of thing which man did. That was the theistic expression. And then there was the non-theistic expression, which is not, it is a mistake to call it impersonal. It is an integration of the impersonal and the personal. I prefer to name it the transpersonal, because the whole fact of person and personality couldn't come into being unless all that was included in the non-theistic affirmations of transcendence as such. Isn't that so? That's straightforward logic, isn't it? So, meditation then is the activity of consciousness at its own transcendent level. You are in the meditative state when you are in the unio mystica, as Christian mysticism puts it. When you are in the cessation, as the Buddhists present it, or as the Upanishads present it, when you are in the turiya, the altogether beyond state, the indescribable state, you see. So we can see at once that meditation, if we continue to use the word meditation, if we continue to use the word meditation for samadhi, you see, it is not thinking in our sense of the word. I have already mentioned what our thinking is like. The inflow of stimuli, the synthesizing by the brain, and making that synthesis into a meaningful pattern by using our faculty of speech. You see? All right. Now, we must bear in mind that our thinking is just our sensuous experience. By sensuous, I don't mean just sensual. The word sensual has become too restricted to sexuality and so forth. All our senses, the functioning of all our senses is what I mean by the sensuous experience. It includes the ordinary meaning of the word sensual and so on, you see. It includes all that. And this is patterned meaningfully by the brain. This meaningfulness is restricted to our finite and temporal existence. Through our sensuous experience and the functioning of our brain, using speech and making meaningful patterns of speech, that is what we mean by the word thought. That is our thinking and all those things we call our thoughts. But they are confined to our finite experience. And you will see how very restricted it is if you consider what would happen if we had more senses than we have now, or a smaller number of senses. We normally have had, since man came on the globe, we have had 5 senses physically. You see? All right. You know that famous story of the blind men and the elephant. Well, I think it will be worthwhile just listening to that story. Once upon a time, there was a Raja who ruled over the city of Savatthi, which was a large and prosperous city. And the Raja asked one of his servants to collect all the men born blind in Savatthi. And then, when you've collected them, bring an elephant into their midst. The man said, "Very good, sire," and did as he was told. And he said to the men, "O blind men, such as this is an elephant." To one man he presented the head, to another its ear, to another a tusk, to another the trunk, and so forth. Now, having done that, So you see, they had only four senses to deal with. Their sense of smell, touch. Touch was the sense that was predominant. Taste, and so forth. And then the men were brought to the Raja, and he asked them, "Well, tell me, blind men, what sort of thing is an elephant?" Thereupon, those who had been presented with the head, "Sire, an elephant is like a pot." Those who observed only an ear, "An elephant is like a winnowing basket." Those who had been presented with a tusk said it was a plowshare. Those who knew only the trunk said it was a plow. They said the body was a granary, the foot a pillar, the back a mortar, the tail a pestle, the tuft of the tail just a besom. Then they began to quarrel, those men, shouting, "Yes, it is. No, it is not. An elephant is not that. Yes, it's like that," and so on, till they came to fisticuffs over the matter. Now you see, give them the sense of sight, and all those, they would have seen that all their descriptions with the conditioning, with the synthesizing activity of the brain using four senses only, you see, would have been utterly negated if the sense of sight were there. So, how far can we depend upon the functioning of our senses where the truth of things is concerned? It's an extraordinary lesson. Now, with our sense of sight, we have gone very, very far indeed in life. Sight plays the far and away the most important part in our lives, in our human life. Supposing now we had another physical sense. All our science and philosophy and everything would undergo a complete transformation, wouldn't it? Because that new sense, assuming it was an advance upon our five senses, just as sight was an advance upon the four senses, supposing that sense were the case, then we would say that, all those human beings, these millions of years, possessing only five senses, they all got it quite wrong. We know the truth. But then they don't, because they are assuming that this is the end point, and so forth. This is where the fly in the ointment comes in, you see. So the thing is this, are there ways of understanding truth in a really profound sense, something which will give us, as far as we human beings can ever attain, reality, understand reality, understand the truth? Now this is where the practice of meditation came in. Samadhi. Samadhi may be translated as the supreme togetherness. Adhi means the topmost, you see, and sang means together. The supreme togetherness. What sort of a thing can this supreme togetherness be? It's a togetherness only in mind and consciousness. The body cannot become the body of the whole world. It can't. But in mind and consciousness, that is pure mind and consciousness, not psyche and consciousness, we can realize a state which is the true at-one-ment, the true unio mystica, the true realization of God, or Brahman, or whatever word you like to use. You see? Good. Our consciousness works in this manner. We don't know consciousness as such. Consciousness is a funny word. It sounds as if it were a kind of an organ, like your liver or your kidney or something. It isn't. When stimuli come to the brain through our sense of sight, and we pay attention to what is happening, you see, and we say, "Oh, I see this, that, and the other. I can say that because I am conscious of the presence of this, that, and the other. I am conscious of its presence," you see. But what is consciousness? something quite different. This is what we don't know really, and we can't define consciousness. To be perfectly honest, we just cannot define consciousness. The ones who realized, made the positive affirmation centuries ago, 27 centuries ago, somewhere there, you see, they made this affirmation that the ultimate reality, your Atma, is pure consciousness. And that's why they use two words, Brahman, the objective word, related to the primordial creative energy, and Atma, related to one's awareness, one's consciousness, you see. Now, I said earlier that when you are truly conscious of something, you are that something. And the brain doesn't know that. Now take, for instance, the beating of the heart and the circulation of the blood and all that. It happens without our paying attention to it, doesn't it? And it's only when something goes wrong with the beating of the heart or the circulation of the blood or our breathing or something, then we become conscious of it, because it is something other to us than our normal healthy state. And in the healthy state, we are not conscious of it. But I would put it the other way around. We are so completely conscious of the heartbeat and the blood streaming and so on, that it just happens. Whatever just happens with us, and just happens naturally, spontaneously, without having to exercise any control or directing influence upon it, that is pure absolute consciousness. I'm sure that all the world will disagree with me on that point. But this is how I feel about it. Take the case of the infant as it grows up. When it is born, it just lies flat on its back. It can't do anything. It even can't turn on its side. Now, you are a fairly recent mother, so you know all about that. You see, for the last, 7-8 years?
Yes.
Yes, you see. It can't do anything at all. All right. And then gradually it begins to do this and begins to do that, and it does it quite naturally. It is only because it is told that it is walking or toddling or running that the word gets associated in the brain with that which happens naturally. But you look at a person who runs perfectly, it happens absolutely naturally and spontaneously, doesn't it? Now that is the meaning of consciousness. This is pure consciousness manifesting as running or walking or whatever it is. This is pure consciousness. And when that is applied to our to the life of the of our psyche, it means that the psyche becomes completely purified before consciousness functions in that manner. That is to say, psychically we are aware of ambivalent functioning. Love, hate, you see, kindness, cruelty, meanness, generosity, and so forth. We are conscious in dualistic terms, and it is that dualism which brings about conflict. That means we are conscious of ourselves as separate and other than one or other of the duals. But when you have become fully conscious of what kindness is or generosity is and how it functions and so forth, you see, then the duals are absolutely absent. And that type of consciousness is the meditative consciousness. The brain has no need, and generally it doesn't function in terms of language and words to express it. The person who really is in the meditative state is in the state of absolute poise, equanimity. It's a blissful state. There is no sensational pleasure attached to it, remember. Bliss is something which utterly transcends physical sensation and pleasure, as well as psychical joy. You can use the word happiness and joy in relation to the psyche, as you can use the word pleasure in relation to the body, a pleasurable sensation, you see, and so forth. The bliss has gone completely beyond all that. So, it is to this end, actually, without their knowing it, without their understanding it at all, the thousands of people say that they meditate, or they go to a meditation teacher and so forth in order to meditate. You see? Now this is a little bit nonsensical, really. Because it is by the natural process of growth that the purification and the perfecting of the psyche takes place. And the purification and perfection of the psyche means that it gets completely empty of all the duals, love, hate, kindness, cruelty, meanness, generosity. It gets completely free of all that. It gets completely free of all our beliefs, every single one of them, and all our conceptions. If and when I were to enter the pure meditative state, all that I am talking now becomes nonsense. Or all that I have talked all these years or written in books is just nonsense. It is the indescribable. Just like when the sense of sight came into being, were to come into being for the blind men, they'd see the elephant as the elephant, as we now call the elephant. Instead of calling the elephant a pot or a besom or a granary or something. You get it? It's like that. So you see, this complete denudation of the psyche has to take place. Now, there is that in us which is a bridge. A bridge which takes us out, which enables us to cross to the other shore, which enables us to step out of our present state, what we commonly regard as the known, into the unknown, the absolute unknown. And so many earnest people don't realize these things because they are afraid of that unknown. You know how in the Bible it is said, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. If you face that fear and accept that fear, you will have the power to move out into the unknown, into the completely unknown. It is to step out into the infinite through death whilst alive. Now I'm using the word death here not in the common garden physical sense of the extinction of the psychophysical organism. Not in that sense. In the psyche, as you attend in the real way, you see, as you attend to everything, completely attend with your whole being, the state of the psyche undergoes transformation all the time. It undergoes transformation. And so that which was besmirched, which was like a solid block obstructing the light of transcendence to come through, it just vanishes into what we would commonly call empty space. And then mind, the universal, and consciousness, the pure consciousness, begins to function through you, the person. You see, that is why they have ascribed extraordinary powers to the perfected holy ones. And those powers must not be misinterpreted as physical feats. This is one of the unfortunate things that has happened through the ages in connection with what they have said in India, in Hinduism and in Buddhism. The Buddha himself has used the same phrases, that you can walk on the waters, that you can disappear into the earth and come out elsewhere, that you can levitate and suddenly be elsewhere. This all refers to the psyche and has nothing to do with the body. You see, there are so many illusions from which we suffer about these things. All that disappears, all that nonsense. This bridge I mentioned, in the Zarathustrian scriptures, it is referred to as the Chinvat Peretu. It is the bridge of the separator, or the bridge of discriminative choice between good and evil. This is the bridge of judgment. You find it in Egyptian teaching, from Egyptian teachings onwards, right up to the time of all the great religions of the world of today, you see. This bridge of judgment refers to this discriminative choice between good and evil. That is its real meaning. And we have that as the gift of transcendence to us. The differentiating process of the ultimate creative energy and the pure consciousness, you see, in its differentiation, although it becomes more and more complex and more concrete as it comes right down to what we understand as our physical level, although it does that, that transcendent state still is in here, in every single cell of our body, in every atom that composes us, in every atom of the universe. There is that divinity locked up. It locks itself up. It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? If you would like to just use the word God, because it's a convenient and a short word, you see, God completely imprisons himself in us. And the purpose of our existence is to release that divinity out of us, so that the supreme aspects of this creative energy and this pure consciousness can function through us and shine through us and bring fulfillment, peace, bliss unto mankind. And thereby God comes to perfection as man through the human race. Just as God comes to perfection through the perfect flower, through the perfect animal, etc., etc., as the flower, as the animal. It is in us that God hasn't come to perfection that way, because, if you like to put it this way, the purpose of our imperfection is that we shall grow into conscious cooperators with this divine vision, with this divine plan, if you like. I think we can put it that way. Now, when you are in that state, then you are in meditation.